even if I kiss these frogs, I don't get any prince. So while I'm studying this genetics, I don't feel that I'm giving anything back to society. And I bumped into the opportunity of using entomology, insects, for criminal investigation. I said, hold on, I can be useful. Nature can be useful. I can provide answers in a very strange and creepy way, I believe, mm-hmm. but that can be much better than the genetics of toads and frogs. Nothing against people that do that, but you had to find fulfillment in life in different ways. And some people do that using bugs for criminal investigation. That's me.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This series delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we will meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them, women who are changing the world from right here in WA. This is Season 3, Episode 4 of Her Story with Dr. Paula Magni. This is Her Story.
Hi, I'm Paula and this is my story. I was born and raised in Italy. I moved definitely to Australia in 2013. So this year is 10 years anniversary of me moving. I came here before for a sort of appetizer of 6 months while I was doing my PhD, but living for good. Indefinitely. I didn't know that was indefinitely, but that happened. It was 2013.
What was it that brought you out to Australia?
Well, in my professional field, we are not that many. And back in the days, WA, Perth, UWA was one of the center of excellence in forensic studies. And I've been invited to spend part of my PhD at the Centre for Forensic Science at UWA, that doesn't exist anymore, but was a huge opportunity for me. So, yeah, I came in 2009 for my PhD and later on to spend a period as a postdoc there.
You came to study entomology, which is the study of insects, right? When you were growing up in Italy, what was that moment where you just went, this beetle is the best thing I've ever seen. I need to know everything about it.
Never happened.
It never happened?
So the story goes that I have been always interested in nature. Mm-hmm. Nature, like everything around me, alive, dead, a rock, a plant, an insect, or a cat, or even a human. I was interested in anything that was around me. Like, as a sort of a, I just want to be David Attenborough and watch things and talk about things and reading books and watch movies and documentaries, reading books and things. So there was not like a favorite animal or favorite organism or plant. I was just in love with everything. As far as was not a doll, not a train, but there was a microscope and something underneath or something that I could put in a pot that I can look, that I can watch for hours. Like the best thing that my mom gave me was an aquarium at some point. Mm. I was spending more time in front of the aquarium looking at the fish going, oh, how boring can it be that, rather than the TV. But for me, it was everything. Like I could spend hours watching that and taking notes of how many turns to the left the goldfish was doing rather than from the right. So it was just weird.
Were you really a 10-year-old Paula sitting there with a notebook and a pen?
Yes, and I was doing that with the aquarium, also with hamsters. I started raising generations of hamsters becoming the little new Mendel, trying to mix and match various colors and see what was the next generation colors. So, yeah, I was, I don't know, a weird kid.
You were doing little Punnett squares for the genetics traits of your hamsters.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I love it. Did you name them? Did they have personalities, or was it solely like a scientific endeavor?
The one I kept, they had names. The other ones, they were just numbers in my research. And I had a deal with a local pet shop that I could give them back in exchange for food, pet food. And so, yeah, I was I was a little Mendel hamster producer and mama annoyer kind of kid.
You had an entrepreneurial spirit even then.
Yeah, I never actually proposed my mom that I could be an entrepreneur. Yeah, that can, yeah.
Did that ever get in the way of your relationships and your friendships as you were growing up? Did you find that people accepted that part of you and just went, oh, well, she likes bugs and animals?
I think it was a very good conversation starter. My friends were introducing me to the other kids saying, ah, she's Paola, she knows everything about animals. And so I tell you a story. Once I was at the primary school, and one of the typical exercises at primary school is flip the magazine to take, I don't know, pictures of food or pictures of animals or picture. So we were doing this job of magazine, scissors and doing this. And I opened a page and there was an advertisement about the WWF. And at the corner right, I remember like it was yesterday, there was a little thing like, if you want to become a member of the WWF, just fill in this form and send through with a proper snail mail letter. And so I got that. This is like the Holy Grail. I went to the teacher like with palpitations, like, can I bring this home? And I went to my dad, please make me become a member of the WWS. Like, I become a member of some sort of cult or something. And so I said, yeah, sure. So I fill in this form, sent to the snail mail, letterbox and things. Months later, they came back with a proper form to fill in. And then months later, the little card with my name, probably written like handwriting from the president at the time, and a little pin with a mini panda. I was not going anywhere without the little pin panda. And everyone was like, this is Paola, she's from the WWF. Like, introducing myself as the FBI person. And if there was, I don't know, there is a bug, call Paola. There is a cat, call Paola. She will tell you things. Like, but I didn't know much more than a normal kid. It's just, yeah, I was just, yeah, the person of reference for any kind of animals. Problem is that when a kid of my class had head lice, they call me as well. And so, wow, that's interesting. And I go lice the day after myself. So, yeah, problems they come with the profession.
But at least then you could study the way that lice travelled throughout the classroom.
Yeah, can you imagine if I wanted to breed them as well?
I can't imagine a lot of people listening are suddenly scratching their heads now. Like,
sorry,
oh,
guys.
Gosh. So you had this fascination with all living creatures and just wanted to continue to explore that. I did a little bit of reading on entomology because I like to pretend that I am the expert on all things. Prior to the 1600s, there was this theory of spontaneous generation where people thought that caterpillars just formed out of mud and butterflies grew from the ooze that the caterpillar left behind.
Yeah, the flesh makes maggots. That was the big theory.
So when you started thinking about all the ways that animals live their lives and develop, did it occur to you that the root of all this, like the base creature, was the insect?
It's interesting because when you study entomology, when you study biology or zoology in general, you find out that reproduction strategies are very different and they can take years or they can take milliseconds and they can be very easy or can be very complex. And then you find things that people used to believe, so they become part of the zoological culture, right or wrong, So yes, one is the flesh makes maggot that is has been then used pretty much as one of the first ways to approach science with a scientific method. So Francesco Redi, there was an Italian as well. Mm-hmm. She put together this experiment with a meat in a jar that was open, meat in a jar that was sealed, and meat in a jar that was kind of open but closed, like a mesh on top. What happens? So mm-hmm. only the meat that was open to the air and to the arrival of the insects made the maggots, because the flies arrive, lay eggs and blah, blah, blah. The meat that was sealed was never colonized. But then you have bacteria inside of the meat that starts to do something. So there is something happening. It's a generation, but it's a spontaneous generation kind of, or something that you will not see unless you wait for a bit and then take over. So they change color, they change structure. The mesh story is interesting because flies would lay eggs on the meat if they could reach it, but they can't. So what they think? Well, if they are small enough, they try to get into the meat mm-hmm. no matter what, and they break their wings and they can get inside. And as far as they can lay the eggs and have the offspring, the generation, doesn't matter if I die, as far as my genetics is carried on. There are others that lay the eggs at the top of the mesh, and the baby maggots, they fall down and they can reach the meat. And this is fantastic because in my work as a forensic investigator using insects, when it comes that a body is found in a suitcase, it's exactly the same story. The person, the body is sealed inside of a suitcase, but because of the zip, that it looks like a mesh, they can pass through. Mm. So I can be useful even if there is a concealed environment. So I can tell things through the insects that otherwise will not be able to be said.
Yeah, because, I mean, we've been very wholesome so far talking about, like, your childhood and watching fish turn left and right. But your job now, what you've done with it, is not very wholesome at all. You're dealing with the really terrible things that happen in our world and trying to find out exactly who and how and why.
Yeah, and so this brings back to the first question, do you like the insects? I'm not interested in the insects because they are insects and going around with an insect net like the mad person on the card or the tarot. I was in love with nature, and when I decided to enroll in the course of natural sciences, that is what I have as a master's degree, nobody was surprised about that. What they were surprised on was when I decided not to do my research period in a huge, beautiful lab that was looking into the genetics of toads and frogs and snakes. That was something I was interested in, because when I found myself in that lab, I said, this is not useful. Mm. This is blue sky science. Fantastic. We will find out more about the chromosome of this frog. But even if I've kissed these frogs, I don't get any prints. So while I'm studying this genetics, I don't feel that I'm giving anything back to society. And I bumped into the opportunity of using entomology, insects, for criminal investigation. I said, hold on. I can be useful. Nature can be useful. I can provide answers in a very strange and creepy way, I believe, mm-hmm. but that can be much better than the genetics of toads and frogs. Nothing against people that do that, but you had to find fulfillment in life in different ways, and some people do that using bugs for criminal investigation. That's me.
How did you bump into it? What was that like when you discovered that this was a possibility?
So as many things that happen in life, it was an academic casualty. I had a problem during my course. I sit in the course of astronomy and I really didn't enjoy that. I was very frustrated with the course, with the professor and things. I decided to change the course. And I went to the main office and said, I want to remove this course. I really don't like it. I love stars and moons, but I really don't like this course. I was not happy. Plan B was, okay, there is no this course. What I can do instead of that? In this period of time, there was entomology, blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's do that. Got into the entomology class and the professor said, insects are everywhere. Fair enough. They're very annoying. They're everywhere. And many people study insects. Okay. Insects, though, are studied if they are useful, like bees, pollinators, and things like that. If they are annoying or because they bring diseases, vectors of diseases of different sort, mosquitoes and things, or because they are beautiful, beetles, butterflies. Some people study specific groups of insects just for their own interest, and that's pretty much it. Ah, by the way, there are some people in the last few years that are considering insects in criminal investigation. That was it. Okay, today we talk about grasshoppers. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, whoa, hold on, what is this about? Now, I'm going to give away my age, saying that at that stage, there was no Google. So I could not go home and put that on Google to find out what's going on. So I went to the main library of the city and I tried to find out something more about that. And I found that this thing that he was talking about was forensic entomology. So entomology applied to investigation, that criminal or civil investigation, depending if we're talking about a bug on a dead body that was an homicide, or if you have a cockroach in a sandwich, civil or criminal investigation. Soon after that, so a few months in, after this event, there was going to be a European conference about that. What, a European conference? So it's not just me interested in that? Cool. Let me go and see what's going on. Who are the people that do that? It's really something that interested me. So that was in London. I flew to London. Was at the Natural History Museum. It was one of my happy places. There were only like 50 people from all around the world doing that. But I was totally fascinated by the possibilities, because for real, like, insects are everywhere. So you can really help out in a situation in which a body is in a suitcase or in an apartment or in the bush, even underwater. And we are talking about water of a bathtub or the ocean or fresh water in a river or a lake. And then you can help out in a situation of hygiene or border security. You can help out in biosecurity. So nearly the possibilities are endless. So that, whoa. I really want to be that person that can help out. And if I had to use bugs instead of blood, fair enough.
It feels to me like it meshes so nicely with how you saw the world as a child, in that it's all about the ways that different life forces, different creatures interact with each other. So not just about the ways that insects develop and reproduce and live their lives, but how they live their lives alongside us as humans.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very holistic as approach, because you don't look at the insect as what it is, but what species, at what age, at what level of development. It is developed in an environment that is like neutral or that has drugs. Because if there is drugs involved, like a body died because of an overdose or a poison, I will find the drug through the insects, and the insect will be a bit strange because of the drugs, and can be bigger, can be smaller, can be half dead. And the insects grow based on the environmental temperature. So it's going to be different if I work on the same exact case in winter or in summer, in the land or in the sea, if the body is hanging from a tree or is in a trash bin, or if the trash bin is in the water. So they become more and more complex. So you had to consider all the variables. So the background in natural sciences for me was like, this is great, because I know something about soil, and now I know how to put soil in the picture. I know how air works. So air that moves around and brings the odor of the composition this way or the other way. And what we call about air and smell for me is volatile organic compounds. That is chemical stuff that require certain movement that cause the insects to do certain things. So really translating the key left by nature as it is into the course of the investigation. So really translating what is there in something that can be useful in court of law.
And you've not just held on to this knowledge and hoarded it so that only you are the person that they can come to for advice and for help, but you've turned that into a app, like an educational tool for police force to be able to do their own preliminary investigations, yeah?
Yeah, the idea is that, as I said, we are not many around the world. So if something happened that is not around the corner, it's not going to be me at the scene with the forceps and the jar and the photographing machine or things. It's going to be a pathologist or a police investigator. So what I will be able to do is receive this sample at my lab and work on it after somebody has done the first couple of steps, that is observation and collection and preservation of the sample. So the app really gives an idea of what anyone can do to provide us with the best evidence possible for us to work on. We published a paper recently that is called the Standard for Proxies. Mm-hmm. And we wrote about gold standard, silver standard, or bronze standard. So the best of the best, you will do this, but it's going to be enough if you do that. Mm. So you don't feel overwhelmed if you are freshly new from the police academy and you are on a case and you just put vodka instead of alcohol on the bags, because we will be able to add correcting factor to vodka rather than normal alcohol on the bag, and we will get the information, providing also the limitation because vodka instead of alcohol.
I guess it's acknowledging what people have on hand and the background knowledge that they already have. What's been the response from those people who are responsible for that first line investigation?
Yeah, it was pretty much thank you, because thank you very much to acknowledging that we have only these. Like, we already have 25 kits, the fingerprint kits, the DNA kits, the toxicology kit. If we add also the entomology kit, mm-hmm. and we need whatever you have in the lab after 20 years of career, it's overwhelming. It's like, no. We do something else. We work on something else. Don't worry about the bugs. Less is more sometimes. So acknowledging that there is lots to do and that we just need the basic things, and then we can work on that.
Can you tell us about a time that you've finished a case and gone home and just been like, wow, that was in my top five career highlights. I feel like I've changed the world today.
I'm lucky enough that kind of moment happened a few times. Probably the moment that resonated with me the most was a moment in which I found myself in court. I was working for the defense, and then a man entomologist was working for the judge. A man entomologist was working for the prosecution, and both of these men were over 50. I was in my 20s, and I provided a report that was, I believe, fantastic, but I'm a bit biased. And the judge, there was a lady at the end of the court case. She approached me and she said, I heard many expert witness, but I never saw such a good expert witness. At your age, your knowledge, I am proud to be a woman in law, to be supported by a woman in science. And that was like the moment. I didn't care if the case was actually lost, because it's not up to me. I did my job, and then, you know, there are more evidence, not just that. We closed the case. But for me, it's not about me. Like, sometimes it's the sisterhood of understanding how difficult was the life of this judge to become one of the big judges in this court, a lady as well. Da, da, da. So she understood my position in a different field, but still the sisterhood of supporting.
Because there are only 120 women in your field around the world.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And we don't do the same exact thing. So someone is more focused on taxonomy. So kind of giving the name to the bugs and giving, you know, information about the species and things. Somebody works more in aquatic stuff, and these aquatic, some people goes more into freshwater rather than the salt water. Some of the people work in toxicology using certain kind of techniques. So it's a difficult community, because we can help each other, but it's very difficult.
Because everyone has their own areas of expertise. You were talking about being complimented for being such a good expert witness, and that's something that you do as well now, is work with people who have been asked to be expert witnesses to develop those skills. What does it take to be a good expert witness in a court case?
That's interesting, because we were talking last week. There was an international conference in Sydney, and someone was talking about science communication and things, and my question at the end was there was no answer to this question. Was would you prefer someone in court that is very knowledgeable, very, very knowledgeable, but with poor communication skills? Or would you prefer to have someone in court that has better communication skills, but not as good science? And that is a big, like, it's the egg or the chicken, because if you had the information but you can't deliver the information, you're not going to sound reliable for the judge and the jury, and especially the jury. The baseline of understanding is that when we are in court, it's not us as an expert or science against the judge, but it's what the jury, they come from the street, understand what we say, they will make the case. So what makes a good expert is the knowledge, but also the possibility, capacity of explaining that in simple words, avoid jargon. You don't sound more intelligent if you put the difficult word, if you call the bat, the insect that has a specific name, Califora vomitoria, you call that the bat. Mm-hmm. It's good enough, you know. Don't try to sound intelligent just because you put the big word. Let these people understand, because that is the point that people to understand.
I've also interviewed Parvinder Kaur as part of this series. And as you were talking then, I remembered the conversation that I had with Parvinder around the importance of science communication and how science education should be about not just the science and the big Latin-y words that you just used. That was very impressive, by the way.
Sounds like Harry Potter, huh?
But also about how you communicate, how you translate that knowledge so that it can be put to use by everyone who's interested.
There's been always this gap in science courses that never been considered the communication. They teach you how to do science, how to do, you know, pipetting around with the lab, how to write a paper, but how to express yourself, how to share your research, how to make your research palatable to other people, it's something that has never been considered. So slowly, slowly, this is coming together and there are more and more opportunities like 3-Minute Stasis, Fame Lab. But even if you make your own TikTok about the science that you're doing, my students is doing an amazing job about that. Follow him, please. It's Bobby the Forensic Student.
Bobby the Forensic Student?
Yes.
Okay, everyone get on TikTok right now.
Yes, I think it's Instagram and TikTok. So Bobby, the forensic student, is sharing his journey in the lab, seeing what he does. And it's lovely because it's not just closed lab. We're not just a lab rat with a lab coat. We're not unapproachable people. We are people that love to share the science. Sometimes we're just, you know, a bit introvert, a bit shy, a bit feeling like people will not be interested in what I'm doing in the lab and things. I'm not a movie star and things, but it's different. Like, as soon as you find out about science, you will be fascinated about that. So we just had to open that loop and then woo.
And share it with enthusiasm and glee and not a sense of needing to prove how smart you are.
Yeah, but also sharing the low moment. Like, when you think about scientists, what do you think? Oh, Marie Curie found the X-rays and things. Oh, the other person made the penicillin. Oh, the other person found the Titanic. Oh, this amazing moment. Yeah, but the amazing moment are some of the top moments. But there are lots of low moments. Mm. So what would be great for scientists to share? What are the low moments and how they approach the low moment, how they recover themselves from that point. You know, it's a roller coaster. Life is a roller coaster. Science is an even worse roller coaster. I've been invited to a Women in STEM Day a few weeks ago, and I went there because I was expecting to hear that. Other women talking about the research that I'm totally not interested about. Oh, do geology, do things, blah, blah. Absolutely not interested. I was not there for the research, because if they were taking me out to a research showcase with a bunch of women that do things that are not related to my life, I have other things to do. I was there because I was eager to listen about these people that have big names, what kind of tips you can share as a woman dealing with kids, school runs, or bad moment, or I want to quit, or my students are giving my head in, or things. As a woman, what did you do to arrive to that point? What are the moments that really brought your career to the point that you can do it? What are the moments of stop? There was nothing about that.
Mm.
And then I approached the chair of the conference. It was, yeah, but you know, because we always think about women, they always talk about problems, they're always drama queens. We just wanted to be focused on the science. And I was like, oh, makes everyone the same.
Mm.
And no, our strength is our resilience. Share your resilience point. Share your tips to be resilient. Share your strength as a multitasker, as a person that comes from another country, as a person that, you know, survive things. So share the bloody vulnerability. Such a beautiful thing that allows you to be human and to be relatable as a scientist. You are a woman in the first place, or a human in the first place.
What is science but the study of how we as humans are interacting with every single element of the world around us. And if we don't keep that human element in it, then, you know,
it's incomplete.
You speak a lot about being a woman in STEM and what people think of when they think of scientists. You have gone this route where you have celebrated those traditionally feminine aspects about yourself, right? So rather than lean into this idea that scientists who are women are very glasses and no makeup and ponytails, which is fine, 100%. You have chosen to celebrate doing your hair and doing your makeup and wearing lovely white silky tops that I would get something spilt on within 5 minutes. Did you ever find that people, and when I say people, I mean men, took you less seriously because of that?
They will never admit that, but I think that was, I mean, it's the combination of what you wear, how young you look, and you know the way you approach. Like, I'm an extrovert, so I love laughing, I love smiling, my eyes smile, as they say. And when they ask me to take a corporate picture in which I don't smile, I look at myself, I don't feel at myself, and I don't take myself serious too much. I take too many things serious in life, so everyone has to feel the best way they can. And for me, it's like, you know, my grandma used to say, dress up in the way you want for the day to go, okay? Mm. So obviously you can't wake up in the morning and have a ball gown to have a ball of a day. But, you know, it's also like, you know, lab is different because then you have to have clothes, shoes and blah, blah, blah. But I have clothes, shoes with bugs on tops and I love it, you know? But I have a very diverse and inclusive lab in which we have like buy one each color and any gender, any kind of fluidity. I love it because everyone brings things to this table. This table is fantastic.
Which is also reflective of the natural world.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And they bring really the ideas in that way.
I find it a very curious sort of misogyny that in order to be taken seriously as a woman, you need to reject anything that is pretty or cute, and that there is a assumption that's made if you walk into a meeting and you're not corporate dressed, and by that I mean like pencil skirts and black and white and monotones and stuff, that what you're going to say won't be taken as seriously as what perhaps someone else will say.
Yeah. Would you take serious someone that is a man dressed up as, I don't know, Elton John to go for a concert? I would probably not take that because there is something wrong about that. I think I like the idea of fitting with the okay, let's go back to nature. If you find something that is odd in nature, something happened. The body has moved from the primary crime scene to the secondary crime scene. I find the wrong bag in the wrong color, in the wrong position. So there is something wrong about that. I think the main thing is that you have to respect yourself, your body, your thoughts, your background, your cultural things. And that is the main thing. There are places to be dressed in certain way. There are places to be dressed in different ways. There are rules in labs. You don't want to spill things on yourself, so you have to be covered. I think I like to be classy, and that's okay. And
I can confirm you're very classy, by the way.
I don't know. I think is you also have to consider that you are in a society and you want to respect everyone as well. It's a matter of accepting, be acceptable,
It's a dance. It's about being true to yourself and how you feel comfortable presenting in the world and understanding the context that you're about to walk into.
Yeah, and then I always love art and things, so I like to mix and match the right colors. Some people don't. Sometimes I had in my head, oh my God, why did this person put these two colors together? And become a lot of distracting material for me. Like, this person is talking to me, and like, why? What was the thinking behind these flowers and stripes together? You know, this is because my mind is always moving and things.
You know, we've been talking about being comfortable with ourselves, the way that we present in the world. If you were going to be an insect,
ooh,
which insect would you be like, this is the power insect?
That's a good question. Let me think. If it's a bad day, one of these cicadas that stay 16 years in the ground. Okay, I go, I love eating. I will probably be the caterpillar. You know, they serve the little caterpillar today. It's giving like 5 apples Tuesday, 2 pieces of cakes and things. And then doesn't matter. You ate everything and day after, you're beautiful butterflies.
Paola, oh my God. The very hungry caterpillar.
Yes.
Thank you so much for making the time to talk to us on Herstory. It's been so interesting learning from the different aspects of your life, because there are so many different strands to this story. I really look forward to following your career, and the way that you share that knowledge with the world is so great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Dr. Paola Magni and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make Her Story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the WA Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Wadjuk Noongarrpuja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au.
If you're enjoying this podcast, you might like to check out others on offer at RTRFM.
Like the award-winning podcast Songlines, chart-topping Sovereign, First Pressing, Mortgage Mag and Favourites Movie Squad.
Plus, don't miss The Wild Orbit of Planet Perth with Jeff Bullen, tune in to Australian Melodrama with Libby Noble and meet local authors on Between the Lines with Danielle Raphael.
Head to rtrfm.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much to explore on your home of alternative stories, RTRFM.